understanding the situation in Ukraine and what it means for the rest of the world. What began in recent months as protests on the streets of Ukrainian cities is now an international crisis, with observers around the globe increasingly worried about the implications of Russia's actions. News reports indicate that pro-Russian forces are tightening their grip on the Crimean Peninsula. And on Sunday, Crimea plans to hold an independence vote, a vote which Western leaders say is illegal. Meantime, Ukraine's current prime minister, whom Russia does not recognize, is set to meet with President Obama tomorrow. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we turn to three scholars of that region to help put the situation in context. What are Russia's end goals? Will this restart the Cold War? Does diplomacy stand a chance? Just a few of the big questions. What are yours? Maine Calling examines the Ukraine crisis. But first, this news update.
With this look at Maine News, I'm Ed Morin. Central Maine Power wants customers who generate some of their own electricity from renewable sources to pay higher monthly service charges to help keep such customers on the grid, even if they don't need power all the time. Solar and wind advocates say the charge would kill the economics of investing in renewable sources. Traditional Maine smelt fishing is being banned in the lower half of the state this spring from Stonington to the New Hampshire border. Jeff Nichols, with the Maine Department of Marine Resources, says the closure will protect smelt at a vulnerable life stage when they are spawning.
One of the major threats that has been identified by our research is a loss of spawning habitat and access to spawning habitat.
State studies show runs of smelt have declined 50% in the closure area in the last few decades. Transportation officials are optimistic that the Memorial Bridge connecting Maine and New Hampshire has not sustained any structural damage. After an oil tanker struck a pier supporting the span late last week, divers are inspecting the bridge today. Taking a look at the weather, flurries come to an end in the north and down east this afternoon. Snow, which could be heavy tomorrow afternoon, arrives in the southwest by late morning, in the east by mid-afternoon, and in the north by dusk. Snow mixes with rain and sleet in York County by late afternoon and along the entire coast during the evening. Precipitation changes back to all snow by midnight. Very windy along the coast late tomorrow and into the night, highs 25 to 39. Periodic snow statewide Thursday, with wind and drifting easing in the west during the afternoon. Accumulations 6 to 18 inches, most across the southern half of the state away from the coast, highs 15 to 26 degrees. With Maine News and Weather, I'm Ed Morin. Maine Calling time is 12:08.
From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The situation in Ukraine remains tense, with no resolution in sight. Ukraine's parliament says it will not recognize the outcome of an independence referendum to be held Sunday in Crimea. The U.S. and its allies have limited options in how to respond to the events there. Today on the program, we will hear from three Russia experts about Ukraine. Just what, if anything, can or should the U.S. and its allies do? What are realistic outcomes of this situation? In the studio with me, Laura Henry. She's acting chair of the Russian department at Bowdoin College. From our studio in Bangor, James Warhola. He is political science professor and chair of the political science department at the University of Maine. And joining us from a studio at Colby College is Paul Josephson, a professor of history at Colby College. We invite you to join our conversation. What are your questions about the crisis in Ukraine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Paul Josephson, I'd like to begin with you. I know that you were recently in Ukraine and in Russia. How recently, and what did you observe there?
I was in Russia about 2 weeks ago in Moscow, and I spoke with a lot of Russian friends about the Olympics and about the beginning of saber rattling concerning Crimea. And I was surprised by the large number of my well-educated friends who seem to buy into much of what the media, the Russian media, are saying about the events in Ukraine.
Does that continue to be the case here 2 weeks later as events have unfolded? Have you remained in touch with those friends?
Yes, I have, and we've agreed to disagree.
Isn't that interesting? Why do you think that is?
I think that the Putin administration has done an excellent job of learning how to control the Russian media. There are very few independent sources of information now. And we've known from the past in other countries and in other times that people at home tend to believe what their government tells them about the outside world, even if they know that things that they hear about their home life is not the way they see it every day.
Hmm. Laura Henry, you know, there's so many questions, but one of my big questions is, what are Vladimir Putin's end goals here? If indeed, as we're reading in reports, he has moved a significant number of Russian troops into the Crimean Peninsula, if indeed there are troops massing on Ukraine's border, are we looking, what are we looking at?
Well, Jennifer, you've asked the $1 million question. What are Vladimir Putin's end goals? And for those who've been following the media, you've seen this debate that's been going on about whether or not this is a carefully devised strategy or just a series of ad hoc decisions based in response to recent events, whether or not Putin is behaving rationally or irrationally, and if rationally, on what basis. I think at the broadest level, we can say that Putin's end game is to draw a line in the sand and say that Russia is a great power that has a sphere of influence, a sphere of influence that's economic and political that encompasses the forthcoming Eurasian Union, which is an economic union, and that they would like to say that Ukraine is an important part of that sphere of influence. Now, what exactly his intentions are for Crimea, what exactly his tensions are for future relations between the state of Ukraine and Russia, I think that is less clear. And I really would weigh in on the side of people who argue that a lot of these decisions have been made in a rush, in an ad hoc way, with limited information and limited input from advisors. And I think that's why we've all been caught off guard by some of the things that have happened. So I'm not sure that Putin really has a well thought out long-term strategy here.
Jim Warhola, we know that Ukraine, of course, used to be part of the Soviet Union and that Vladimir Putin has said that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was a terrible mistake. And we know that Crimea is a region with many ethnic Russians. But what else is important to know about how we got to this place?
It is true that Crimea is predominantly ethnically Russian, somewhere in the neighborhood of 60%. The last official census put the figure at about 58.2, I think, or something. It seems to be a little bit higher than that. How did we get to this place? You know, if you look back in the long stretch of history, Ukraine has gone. It was under Greek control a long, long time ago. It was under the control of the Mongol Tatars, who were still about 12% of the population. It was under Ottoman Turkish control until 1774, at which time it came under Russian control. It was annexed to the Russian Empire in 1783, and then in 1954, Khrushchev transferred Crimea from being part of the Russian Federation within the USSR to being part of Ukraine, which was an interesting move, and there are certain reasons he had for doing that.
But that's within many people's lifetime. People remember that.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so for many people there, it historically was part of Russia. From the Ukrainian perspective, and again, if you want to take the long-term historical view, back in the days when Russian nationhood emerged, and it did so in the area of what is today Ukraine, by the way, in that old what they called the Kievan Rus or the Kievskaya Rus, that old principality along the Dnieper River, that as it grew, Crimea was even then under control of that proto-Russian state back in the 9th century and 9th and 10th centuries A.D. So it's a complicated picture on a number of different fronts.
I'm going to read some headlines. Just these aren't even headlines. This is what has crossed the AP wire in the last hour about this situation. There's a Dateline Kiev that says the Crimean Parliament has just voted that the Black Sea Peninsula will declare itself an independent state if its residents vote to split off from Ukraine and join Russia in a referendum on Sunday. Crimea's regional legislature on today adopted a declaration of independence of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea. Another story, Dateline Moscow. Ukraine's fugitive president has accused his country's new government of fomenting a civil war and criticized the West for supporting it. And another, Dateline Kiev. Ukraine's acting president has called for the formation of a National Guard and for the mobilization of reserves and volunteers into the country's armed forces in order to counter Russian military aggression. It sounds like war. Would you agree, Paul Josephson?
Well, things are not getting better. That's for sure. This plebiscite is quite provocative. To have a vote that gives people two choices, either become part of Russia or to follow some second path, which is really unclear. I've seen the ballot itself. There's no alternative there for people to say, wait, we'd like to be part of Ukraine. I think the people don't realize that should they become part of Russia, that they'll have to deal with all sorts of trade and other barriers. And I think that the political leaders on both sides are just digging in their heels. I think this is part of, as Laura said, Putin and Putinism, where you have an oligarch who's built his power on big power symbolism, on reconquering the Arctic, on having a military resurgence, on symbolically controlling parts of Ukraine if he can. And I agree with Laura that this is really not well thought out, and it's leading to an escalation between Russian and Ukrainian leaders, quite sadly.
Laura, in your view, does diplomacy have a chance?
Well, I do think that aside from Vladimir Putin's regime, many actors in the situation have acted with restraint. I think the Ukrainian government, under the advice of the EU and the U.S., has avoided provocation as much as possible to give the Russians an excuse, for example, to go into eastern Ukraine. So some of the more nationalist groups, which could easily go to Donetsk or Kharkiv and, get into a violent struggle with pro-Russian activists, have refrained from doing that. There's a lot of talk about an off-ramp. That was the big thing 10 days ago or a week ago. Was there a way to de-escalate this crisis and allow everyone to save face, recognize every actor's interest to some degree? As things escalate, it becomes harder and harder to envision what that off-ramp is. You know, the OSCE team, which was supposed to go in and observe whether there was ethnic violence going on, has tried three times to cross the border from... Well, I'm saying the border. It's not a border from Ukraine to Crimea. Just cross into Crimea, and they have been refused every time. But now people are talking a lot about whether or not there could be some kind of constitutional reform in Ukraine that would create more of a federal system, more autonomy for Crimea. I wonder if, we haven't already moved past that option as well.
And Jim Warhola, I want to talk about what this means for U.S.-Russia relations. Are we... Is it too big of a statement to say, are we restarting the Cold War here?
Well, the Cold War was its own era, and this is a little, it's a different situation. I wouldn't characterize it as a restart of the Cold War, but certainly U.S.-Russian relations are, they're not particularly good right now. Although, curiously enough, on Sunday afternoon, when Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov met with Putin, and they had a discussion, and they published the transcript of the exchange on the Russian Foreign Ministry's website, and And they, President Putin and also Foreign Minister Lavrov continue to refer to, you know, our partners in the United States and our partners in, you know, in Europe. And it I mean, surely they're not oblivious to the degree of you know, division between, you know, Russia and the U.S. And Russia and the West on this. But it just struck me as very curious that they were using this kind of language. It seems to me, I don't know if this following commentary is going to jump us ahead a little bit or not, but it seems to me that you know, in terms of an off ramp, I just don't see Russia retracting its influence over Crimea. I mean, you know, perhaps they could be persuaded to do so if Ukraine as a whole, you know, did not go into the to the Western camp. But in terms of, if I could also just respond a little bit to the question that you posed to Laura Henry about, you know, Putin's large-scale goals in this, it seems to me that his large-scale goals were twofold. Number one, you know, to continue with this Eurasian Economic Union. It was supposed to have gone into effect as of 2015, and for that, Ukraine was a vitally important part. That's why back in the middle of November, the Russian administration put such intensely heavy pressure on the Yanukovych regime not to sign those agreements with the European Union. Putin was interested in keeping Russia as part of this prospective, well, actually, it already exists, this Eurasian Economic Union, it's called, but it's in the process of expansion. And if Ukraine were to bolt and go to the West, that would be not good. If Ukraine were to further bolt to the West and go and join NATO, that would be even worse. That seemed to be Putin's first goal. Secondly, to make sure that the kind of uprising that occurred in Ukraine didn't spread into Russia itself. Yanukovych has the dubious distinction of being the only leader pushed out of power twice by a popular revolution, once in 2004 in the Orange Revolution, and now again just a few weeks ago. And, you know, those so-called color revolutions in Georgia 2003, in Ukraine in 2004, and Kyrgyzstan in 2005, those really rattled the Putin administration. In fact, some scholars have argued that the basic contours of the Putin administration evolved out of their determination that there would be no more color revolutions in the former Soviet areas and certainly not in Russia itself. So the events from November until February, I think, really rattled the Putin administration, and they're absolutely determined that something like that is you know, is just simply cannot be.
Mm. Jim Warhola, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Jennifer, I just wanted to say that there is evidence that most Ukrainians, even those in the Russian-speaking parts of the east of the country, do not want to be under Russian influence, be part of that Russian economic sphere, but are, in fact, turning to Europe already. And there's also evidence, photographic and otherwise, that many of the agitators who have appeared in cities like Kharkiv and Dnipropetrovsk and Donetsk and so on have been the same individuals traveling from city to city. I think we're seeing a repeat of what happened in Georgia and in the Transnistria region of Moldova some years ago, where the Russian government has used the presence of Russian passports in these areas to try and re-exert influence. But I think the Ukrainians, by their behavior, are showing that they really do look towards Europe for the future. And the rejection of Yanukovych wasn't just because of the fact that he turned back towards Russia. It was that he was a corrupt leader. No sooner had he been thrown out that people took taxis and cars and buses out to his palace 20 kilometers outside the city to see his zoo and his gold toilets and his, you know, just symbols of his and not only his, but of the leadership's kleptocratic rule. So I think this is both a turn to the West and a rejection of kleptocracy as a form of government.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Northeast Delta Dental, administering dental benefits for businesses of all size in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. Details online at nedelta.com.
Next time on The World, a one-inch Lego figure. He carries a little Lego camera and travels around shooting landscapes.
He went everywhere I went for a whole year.
That's photographer Andrew White, who's taken hundreds of pictures of the Lego camera guy in scenes around Britain.
On location, every day, whatever weather conditions on this glorious and blustery island.
Britain, Lego size, next time on The World.
Join us for The World coming up at 3 o'clock today here on MPBN.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the latest on U.S.-Russia relations and the latest on the ongoing situation in Ukraine. Joining us today, Laura Henry, acting chair of the Russian Department at Bowdoin, Paul Josephson, professor of history at Colby College, and from our Bangor studio, James Warhola, a political science professor and chair of the political science department at the University of Maine. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Opening the phones now and going to Kathy in Waldo. Hi, Kathy, go ahead.
Hello. Bear with me. I have a cold. The role of the United States in this whole thing is highly, not just questionable, but hypocritical. We all recall hearing the conversation between Victoria Nuland and the American ambassador, in which Ms. Nuland says, now we're midwifing this thing. Now what does that mean? We're going to give birth to a new situation here? Why is the United States midwifing this situation in Ukraine? Why were they doing that? And if I were Mr. Putin, I would certainly take umbrage at that and act with great deliberation to forestall any further meddling by the United States, because that was absolute meddling. And then we have the phone call between the Estonian foreign minister and Catherine Ashton, And the Estonian foreign minister had been to Kiev and said that he had spoken with medical people who were sure that the snipers on the roof were on the rooftops.
Now, one of the most difficult things in all of this, isn't it, Jim Warhola, is all the conflicting information we're getting. I mean, we're getting so much information out of Ukraine, out of Russia, out of our own State Department, out of the European Union. What to make of it all, and what to make of what is the U.S. interest in this? Why, as Kathy says, why are we meddling in this?
Okay, well, thank you, Kathy, for the call. And yeah, that probably wasn't the most sagacious or circumspect choice of words by Nuland. But at any rate, that's what she said. And I suppose it does reflect to some degree this idea in Washington, D.C. that the United States has an obligation to help other countries move from an authoritarian path to a democratic path. And at least that's, I think, the gloss that, in fact, I'm quite sure that that's a gloss that the State Department would put on that. I think it might be useful, and whether or not the United States is acting hypocritically or not, I suppose, you know, there are very deep differences of opinion on that. It might be useful to look at this, if we can, from the perspective of Moscow. What do they see? Here's what they see. And this is reflected in the various statements out of the Russian Foreign Ministry, out of President Putin himself, and so on. Here's what they see. From the middle of November until he was ousted in the end of February, Yanukovych, here you had a reasonably democratically elected president of Ukraine. The West didn't particularly like him that much. Putin didn't like him that much, to be perfectly honest with you. The relations between the two are, you know, rumored to be rather prickly. But he was more accommodating to Russia than he was to the West, Yanukovych. He was elected in 2010 in an election that, from the perspective of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is the principal international monitoring organization, according to the OSCE, according even to the State Department, for goodness sakes, that election of Yanukovych in 2010 was reasonably clean and fair and democratic. So that's what Moscow said. Look, you've got this democratically elected president. He's pushed out of power by a popular uprising. On February 21st, according to Moscow, and in this they're factually correct, on February 21st, President Yanukovych signed an agreement with some of the opposition leaders acceding to their demands. The pressure on Yanukovych continued to mount, however, and he left. So from Moscow's perspective, it was, you know, they're calling this a coup d'etat. And Vladimir Putin, in fact, even went on to say that, well, we can't recognize the current government of Ukraine because they came to power and they're ruling by dictatorial means. And so I guess we in the West could say, well, it takes one to know one, I suppose. But at any rate, that's what Moscow sees. And they say, so from their perspective, it is hypocritical for the United States to, you know, to be pushing out a democratically elected president and bringing into or helping to come to power and consolidate the power or the authority of a regime that is much more favorable to the Western world. From my perspective, I think what that misses is that the Moscow perspective is you know, they seem to have assumed in the color revolutions in 2003 and 4 and 5 and also in this current circumstance that the opposition to those regimes was somehow goaded on by the Western world in a way that would not have happened if the Western world weren't meddling. And in other words, they have a hard time accepting the fact, it seems to me, that the popular pressures against these, you know, just really corrupt kleptocratic regimes, that the pressures for those are coming from within the population itself, that it's not George Soros that's causing this, it's not the State Department, that people are just, you know, tired of living under that kind of regime. And so that's what, you know, I would have to say about that, I suppose.
Thank you. And thank you, Kathy, for your question. This is an email from Ben, who lives in Brunswick. Back in 1990, I was visiting then Soviet Crimea and saw a protest of Crimean Tartars in Yalta. Since then, I understand that many more of them have resettled into Crimea. Could any of the experts talk about the position and role of the Crimean Tartar minority during this crisis? And what are attitudes of Russians and Ukrainians toward the Crimean? Am I pronouncing it right, Paul? Tatars. And I apologize for that. Paul, would you like to answer Ben's email? Paul Josephson, do you know about the treatment and the attitude?
How does this sound? I think my mic.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, go ahead.
In the Russians, as Jim pointed out, really conquered Crimea in the 18th century, and the Tatars attempted to develop an independent country right after the Russian Revolution, 1917. But a fierce war by the Bolsheviks against them brought the Tatars and Crimea back within the Soviet Union. And in 1944, accusing the Tatars of having worked with the Nazis, Hitler, Stalin ordered all Tatars to leave Crimea. He required them, 240,000 people were marched to Uzbekistan. At least 100,000 people died en route. And this explains in part why Russian and Ukrainian citizens have higher percentages of citizens in Crimea than Tatars, who were decimated and forced from their homeland. The Tatars have been unwilling to be very vocal the last few weeks because they fear a reprisal from people in uniform and not, from Russians who are behaving in a rather thug-like fashion on the peninsula. And but as of this Saturday and Sunday, you began to see more of these people demonstrating. I've forgotten, maybe Jim knows, something like 12% or Laura.
Yeah, 12% of the, right.
of the current population.
Yeah, it's about,
is
that's about
Tatar.
Right, about 12%, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and so, there, and if go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say that. Yeah. So I think that answers Ben's question that whether this will ever be a Tatar land again, I doubt sincerely. Whether the Russians can claim it as theirs because many retirees and others have settled there and do so with threats of violence is another matter entirely.
Can I make
a
comment?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead,
here?
Jim.
Okay. Yeah. No. Everything Paul said is just exactly right. The only thing that I would add, or actually a couple of things, that all the evidence is that the Crimean Tatar population is pretty heavily against either annexation by Russia or Crimea becoming an independent, or it's allegedly independent country. What they seem to prefer overwhelmingly is to stay a part of Ukraine with the current, at least the current technical constitutional status in place, that is, of there being an autonomous region within Ukraine. All the evidence is that they're really, really nervous right now, and understandably so. Turkey. I'll later on, if we have time, I'd like to make a comment or two about Turkey's role in all this. But they're looking to the Crimean Tatars. In brief, are looking to to Turkey to provide some sort of, if nothing else, humanitarian support for them, and perhaps also some political support. Turkey, for its part, is walking a very, very fine diplomatic line in this. But or at least what I see in there is I just don't see Russia backing down from this sort of de facto amputation of Crimea from Ukraine and maybe a little later on. Yeah, yeah.
Well, sorry, Jim.
Yeah,
one
go ahead,
brief
Paul.
Thing
yeah.
to
yeah.
add.
Go ahead, yeah.
Just if you consider the fact that Crimea is a peninsula, 70% of goods and services, including water, to Crimea mm-hmm. come from Ukraine and electricity. What would happen if Russia annexed this place? The Tatars and Ukrainians there have reason for fear, as do the Russians, just from an economic point of view. But forgive me for going on.
Laura Henry, I want to ask you about the referendum on Sunday. What are the chances that this referendum will be I'm searching for the right word. Will there be international monitors there? Will it be something that has any sense of legitimacy, at least from how the outside world looks at it?
So my understanding is that there will not be any international monitors there, and there is not a lot of good polling data, in part because things are moving so quickly and people are becoming increasingly polarized. And so I think even from week to week and day to day, opinions change. Now, it's very possible that Crimea will vote yes to join Russia, to become an oblast or a region of Russia. But will it be seen as legitimate? I mean, Russia is currently there engaged in a military occupation, whether the troops have the insignia of the Russian military or not. And so that's a big obstacle to legitimacy. But I don't think the intention of the referendum is to try to achieve international legitimacy. I mean, it might be some kind of very superficial conformity with international norms. But the idea is to give, to give Vladimir Putin more legitimacy domestically to kind of proceed with whatever choice he makes as far as how to go about controlling Crimea, whether it's through a proxy government or whether it actually does become part of Russia, the Russian Federation. So I do not think that any kind of referendum on Sunday is going to hold great sway among the international community.
You also study the European Union. Hold on a second, Jim. You also study the European Union. Laura, what options does the EU have, and what is the EU facing that the U.S. perhaps is not facing? I mean, this obviously is their backyard.
Right. Well, the EU has a lot more to lose in terms of both its own very weak economic recovery and how much it relies on oil and gas from Russia, primarily gas, primarily Germany and some of the East European states, how much it relies on Russian finance and the banking system, things like that. So the European Union has been more cautious than the U.S. about trade sanctions. Part of that is because it's very difficult for the European Union to act collectively. It's 28 different member states who have to come together to form common policy and common action. But part of it's because they're deliberating in a way that they're trying to think about what will be the cost to themselves. And I think we don't, in the U.S., face quite as much of an economic blowback, or what Lavrov called the boomerang. He said that any trade sanctions will certainly boomerang back on those who put them into place. And the EU has to contend with the preferences of Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, and she believes in soft diplomacy. She believes in engagement. She believes that they have more influence over Russia while they're trading, while they're in dialogue. And so her preference has been definitely to go slowly. However, the European foreign ministers are meeting today. They said by Monday at the latest they'll make their announcements about what they're going to do.
Okay, we need to go to another short break. When we get back, Jim, we'll go back to you and we'll have more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, committed to canning their entire line to protect the beer and the environment. BaxterBrewing.com.
Feeling overwhelmed by the demands of being a working parent? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bridget Schulte about her new book, Overwhelmed. It draws on research into time management and stress, considers how couples share responsibilities, and how employers and the government have dealt or not dealt with the number of working women and men who need time for their children. Join us.
Tune in to Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock here on MPBN. Many television viewers watch MPBN on Time Warner Cable. If you are among them, please note, Time Warner Cable is adjusting their channel lineup, and it will affect what channel you can find your MPBN channels on, including our main channel, World, Create, and the Main Capital Connection. Time Warner plans to adjust their channels statewide, but right now the adjustments affect just Southern Maine, Cumberland and York counties, as well as Eastern New Hampshire. The MPBN main channel is still on Channel 10, but the high-definition main channel is now at 1221, World is at 1276, Main Capital Connection at 1277, and Create at 1278. For more information, visit our website, mpbn.net, or you can always call MPBN Audience Services at 800-884-1717. And thanks.
Brooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Russia, the U.S., and Ukraine. On the line with us from our Bangor studio, James Warhola, political science professor and chair of the political science department at the University of Maine. In the studio with me, Laura Henry, acting chair of the Russian department at Bowdoin College, and from Colby College, Paul Josephson, who is a professor of history at Colby. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Jim, I'm sorry, before our break, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
Oh, that's okay. Thank you for bringing me back for the comment. I completely agree with everything that Laura said about this upcoming referendum on Sunday, and also the comments that Paul made earlier. From my perspective, the entire exercise looks like a charade piled on top of a charade piled on top of a charade. And as evidenced by the fact that first of all, the choices presented to the people are not particularly broad. It's that is either be annexed to Russia or to become independent. And also the fact that the Crimean Tatar representatives to the Ukrainian parliament tried to get in there this last week, and they were barred from doing so. That tells me something right there about just what the character of this charade is. And if I may, just take a quick moment to comment on these two choices here: either annexation to Russia or an independent Crimea. It seems to me that if you're annexed to Russia, that would probably be to Russia's terrible disadvantage, because it would that would just cause a lot of problems in the other former Soviet areas in which there is also a heavy or a sort of substantial Russian minority population, Kazakhstan in particular, but also some to some degree also Uzbekistan and some of the other former Soviet areas that if Russia went about annexing Crimea, the foreign ministers of those countries are walking a very, very fine line on this. They're not coming out and supporting Putin. They're not really condemning him. They're really walking a very fine line.
Interesting.
And the second thing, yeah, if I could just make a quick point about the independent Crimea option. There are a number of advantages for this for Russia. And one of them is that, let's just say they have their charade referendum on Sunday and Crimea votes to become independent. What would that mean? Well, among other things, that would effectively bar Ukraine from joining, not necessarily the European Union, but from joining NATO. One of the stipulations for becoming a member of NATO is that a country cannot have any outstanding territorial disputes. Mm-hmm. And if Crimea ends up being declared an independent country by itself, recognized even only by Russia and a few of its very closest allies, that would effectively prevent Ukraine from going into NATO, and that would be a major foreign policy success for
Interesting.
Moscow. It's essentially what they did after the Russian invasion of Georgia of 2008. They carved out those two territories, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, shortly thereafter declared them independent countries. Nobody else recognizes them as independent countries. The only people that do are Russia. Nicaragua.
But it limits Georgia's options. Yeah, yeah.
Well, going of course. And it prevents it from joining NATO.
Yeah.
So, among other things, yeah.
Going to the call is going to go to Heidi in Freeport. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead.
Hi. I would like to know if anybody is discussing this, especially on today, the anniversary of the disaster that caused the Fukushima disaster, if anybody is discussing the safety and security of the Chernobyl plant in the Ukraine, and if there's been any kind of governmental oversight on that situation.
Paul Josephson, you've studied Chernobyl. What can you say about that?
Well, a couple of things. It's a very complex situation, although the EU and Ukraine are now finishing a new facility to entomb the Chernobyl number 4 reactor. Things are stable at Chernobyl in terms of that facility once this new covering is complete within the next 6 months or so. Ukraine is also developing nuclear waste storage facilities within the Chernobyl territory in accordance with International Atomic Energy Agency standards and as part of the EU and in consultation with European and other international nuclear specialists. But there's a different problem that may arise, and that is the fact that Ukraine produces over 50% of its electricity from nuclear power and stations that were built in the Soviet period. Ukraine has to buy its fuel for those reactors. It's enriched uranium fuel from Russia. It actually mines zirconium for the fuel rods and sends it to Russia for processing. And it also is a source of uranium ore for those fuel rods. So it's conceivable that Russia could use its economic levers, not only gas and oil, but also access to nuclear technologies that Ukraine needs to operate for the long term, its nuclear power stations, forcing Ukraine perhaps to go to Westinghouse in the United States or some other country. So I'm not too concerned about the stability and safety of Chernobyl today as opposed to over the past 10 years. It's a dreadful accident with long-term consequences, but it's not any less stable because of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
Well, thank you, Heidi. Good question. Going to Scott in Brooksville. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Yes, your guest talked about propaganda in Russia before. There's a lot of propaganda in the United States, too, and hypocrisy. I think the worst example is when John Kerry said, you don't invade other countries on false pretexts to advance your own interests. Does weapons of mass destruction or Iraq mean anything to him? And also, I do think we're pushing Russia into this. I mean, we've advanced through all the NATO, all the Warsaw Pact countries, the Baltic countries. Russia's, you know, they have interest. They're not going to take any more. And also, your guest talked about unpredictable. This is very predictable if you read history. Russia's been wanting warm water ports since the time of Peter the Great, and they're not going to give this up without a big fight. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, Scott. And I'll turn to you, Laura Henry. A lot of points he made, but that last point about warm water ports, and that point's been made a lot in the news media over the last couple weeks. This is where the Russian naval fleet, I understand, is based off of the shores of Crimea. How much of all of this is simply strategic?
Well, it is true that Russia's main warm water port is on the Crimean Peninsula. And when the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, there was an agreement that Russia would be able to lease that territory, lease that base until 2042. And so they have that lease. Of course, it depends in part on relations between Russia and Ukraine, how that actually works. And I do agree with the caller that it would be unlikely Russia would ever want to give up that territory. But, you know, what I would say is that, you know, there are lots of layers to this problem. There's an economic layer to this problem. There is a strategic layer to this problem, which the caller's question points out, military. But there's also an identity layer to this problem. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so challenging to resolve. Really, what is Russia's natural sphere of influence? Where does Russia's kind of cultural and linguistic influence extend to? What is the appropriate post-Cold War role of Russia in the world? I mean, to get to the caller's first part of the question, there's plenty of hypocrisy to go around. Obviously, the big lesson of this is that great powers violate international norms as they will. Now, and of course, it's more convenient for the U.S. if Russia isn't a great power, if Russia doesn't violate. And Russia's really in a somewhat trickier situation than you might imagine. I mean, one thing we haven't mentioned is Chechnya. Obviously, since the early to mid-1990s, there has been a nationalist campaign and a civil war going on for Chechnya to achieve its independence from Russia. So if parts of Ukraine can split off, declare themselves independent, and join Russia, you know, the Russian Federation is a multi-ethnic state, and it's violating international norms in this way is actually probably a more consequential issue for Russia than it has been for the U.S., which has been able to get away from it.
That's a really interesting point about Chechnya. I hadn't thought about that. Going to Jen in Orono. Jen, go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I have...
Can you turn down your radio, Jen?
Oh, yeah,
are you
I'm
within
so sorry.
Arm's
Hold
distance?
On.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. Okay. When this all surfaced for us, by and large, the Ukrainians started gathering in the streets several months ago because the newly quasi-elected president decreed that they could not have free speech. So in the beginning, it was a free speech. When it surfaced, the way the media is running it now. But it is an interesting way to manipulate the chess pieces of war. If you have, for one reason or another, succeeded in gaining some autonomy, and you have a person elected who must deal with its former ruler, and they decree that there is no free speech gathering, well, naturally, people are going to gather in the streets. And that gives the first real potential, right after hopefully settling down into some kind of autonomy, for a breakup of the situation. But further, the patriarchy has to stop looking at energy and the separation of peoples and the whole situation as being tied to money and energy. which almost every conflagration that is going on right now has its culture manipulated in order to fill the oligarchy and the, you know, all the people that belong to the Trilateral Commission and the layers and layers and layers of people who have the largest amount of money, and that's all they care about.
Jim Warhola, would you like to respond to Jen?
Sure. Yeah, I think that Jen is referring to the decision made in the middle of January by the Yanukovych regime to, and they effectively just sort of rammed through the Ukrainian parliament a series of laws that pretty severely restricted public demonstrations and protests, and it didn't exactly proscribe free speech, but it certainly had a or at least my understanding is that the legislation that they rammed through just had a very constricting effect on public demonstrations and protests and things of the sort. And that, of course, just threw gasoline on the fire, so to speak. It was not, in retrospect, a very smart thing for the Yanukovych regime to do, but they did it, and that's really what boiled the pot over. I think the protests started, in the middle of November, and they continued. But when those measures were taken by the Yanukovych regime, that seemed to have pushed the protesters over the edge.
Laura Henry, we just have less than a minute here, so I'll let you.
And if I could add to what Jim is saying, I think also is the decision to use police brutality, first initially against students in early December, that brought more protesters out onto the street, and then the decision to actually use force with the snipers on the roofs shooting at demonstrators.
Okay, well, it's a good question, Jen. Thanks so much for calling in, and it's going to have to be our last question today. Laura, James, Paul, thank you all for joining us. Laura Henry is acting chair of the Russian Department at Bowdoin College. James Warhola is a political science professor and chair of the political science department at the University of Maine. And Paul Josephson is a professor of history at Colby College. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Jonathan Woodward ran the board with technical assistance from John Keimel. Rich Tozier and Nick Godfrey provided technical assistance from our Bangor studio. Lucas Randall Owens answered your calls. We had additional assistance from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/MaineCalling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. Tomorrow on the program, Patrick Kelleher, Commissioner of the Maine Department of Marine Resources. Join me for a discussion about the latest news on lobstering, elvers, the state's fishing industry, and other things. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.